From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
We don't care if your age is 10 or if you're a senior citizen, because we got a beat that just won't end. So you better get ready to rock, my friend. See, we got some news that you can use, and offer that you can't refuse. We're giving up, honey, and you got to come, because you're the one.
Long before P. Diddy and Eminem and today's thousands of DJs and rappers, Joseph Sadler set up two turntables in a Bronx park, worked his magic on the vinyl, and became Grandmaster Flash. What Louis Armstrong did for jazz, Grandmaster Flash helped do for hip-hop music, pushing it from an inner-city novelty to a worldwide sensation. With an extraordinary sense of rhythm and possibility, Grandmaster Flash turned the humble turntable into an instrument as potent in its way as the piano or guitar. When young men leaned into his microphone to talk and sing over his spinning, the birth of rap was underway. Joseph Sadler, Grandmaster Flash, grew up fascinated with all things electronic and how they worked. He was a tinkerer, not content to just let the record turn. With his early idols, Kool Herc and Pete DJ Jones, he invented a new way of DJing that included scratching, cutting, and spinning the records into a tapestry of sound that is still the vocabulary for hip-hop DJs today and the baseline for a world of rap. Grandmaster Flash is still working the turntables and the crowds. He has two new CDs out and is mixing and performing in clubs across the country. We met up with him earlier today.
Raheem's gonna do the rest. Say my name is Raheem. I'm the son of a queen. I'm the king of my castle. Don't give me no hassle. Young ladies in the place, put me on. When I'm a part of your life, you can never go wrong.
Grandmaster Flash, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You were one of the very original guys who saw what could be done with a turntable back in the days of DJ Kool Herc and Afrika Bambaataa. And when I look into your bio and see you've got this early childhood fascination with electronics, it starts to all make sense to me. You looked at that turntable as somebody who understood it mechanically.
Well, I think probably my first love for this thing here is probably anything that you can plug into a wall was my first interest. And this is before I even met with the turntables. Basically, I would take apart anything that was in the household, like a radio or the stereo in the living room,
right,
or whatever the case. I mean,
get your hands on it.
I was relentlessly trying to figure out why these things did what they did and why they did what they did. So along with that, my interest was records. So what I would do is my father had like this incredible jazz collection.
The forbidden jazz record closet.
Yeah, I used to get my head knocked off for. I was told sternly, you cannot go into that closet right there. And what I would do is I would get a chair from the kitchen, you know, because I was a tot then, sort of slide it up the hallway to this infamous closet, just enough where I can reach the knob, turn the knob, climb down. And then what was so intriguing about my father's stereo was when you turned the turntable on, there was a little red light at the bottom.
Sure, I remember those.
And it probably was the beginning of me just continuing to get my head kicked off, because I loved
staring at that little red light.
Little red light, and I used to love things that spun around. So it was like, you know, I would go get these records, go to the stereo, you know, drag this chair, put the record on, get in the middle of the floor and start dancing. And of course, I would try to, you know, put everything back the way it was. And,
good luck.
Very unsuccessful with this.
So you got in trouble, but your parents also saw your obsession here, and they got you into electronics school. They said, hey, let's make use of this.
Now, I think probably I became publicly a public enemy number one in my house, because if the hairdryer was broke, I was like, Joseph! Or, you know, if the radio was broke, or if something electrical was broke, you know, because I would always try to put it back together. You know, it's like, you know, my mother just said, you know, listen, you just can't continue to do this. So I might as well just, you know, when you get old enough, I might as well send you to a school where you can sort of identify with these things that you want to know
clearly
what
are
do.
Into. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's when I began to learn, like, what was a diode, what was a resistor, what was a capacitor, what was AC versus DC, what's a push-pull circuit, what was step-down transformers, what was why the resistors had these pretty colors on it. And those colors represented numbers, and that's how you read how the value of it, why a capacitor does what it does.
So here's young Joseph Sadler, born in Barbados, being raised in the Bronx, and sent
actually
in-
born in the Bronx. My family hails from Barbados.
Oh, okay, okay. Correct. Sorry, I got it wrong.
That's okay.
Got it wrong.
You know, so basically that was kind of it. That's where it started. So
now you're off at electronic school, but you turn back into the music. What gets you actually out in public with the turntables, bringing everything you know about the electronics to the turntable, to the music?
Well, I think probably at that time, there was this great guy, man. He was one of my inspirations. He used to come out in the park. His name was Clive Campbell, and his street name was Cool Herc. And I was told, like, you know, there's this guy, you know, that plays this real great music, because the music at that time that you heard on the radio was disco. So he was playing this other music. And then, you know, for us to go see this guy, there was, like, hundreds of people around, and here's this 6 feet and change guy, heavily guarded with this incredible sound system, playing these songs.
And making an impression on the future Grandmaster Flash.
I think, yeah, you can say that, but I mean, what I found intriguing, like I had two heroes. It was Cool Herc and it was like Pete DJ Jones. And the thing was with Cool Herc, I loved the music that he was playing. But in the fashion he was playing it, it wasn't seamless. It was like, you know, he might play a record that was 82 beats per minute, and then the next one might be 110, where, you know, if you're watching a bunch of heads dancing to the beat at the same time,
they can't make that transition.
It's like I call it disarray in unison. You know, so it would be unison, and then when you would change the record, it would be disarray, because everybody had to find the beat,
find
and then unison. So that became like the focal point of my frustration. Like, there has to
how
be
to
a
work
way,
out that transition.
How to work it out where it can just be seamless.
Do you remember the first time that you were at the turntables with the people dancing, watching those bobbin heads, finding that seamless way?
Oh, yeah, I remember. I think when I took, like, early part of my childhood, and I sort of stayed in my room. I dragged whatever electronic items from, like, abandoned cars or stuff that people threw away in the garbage, you know, anything electrical, and just like learning how to just sort of jury-rig things together. And after I was able to put together a system, when I first came out with this technique of DJing, I figured if I took the most exciting part of, let's just say, 10 records, duplicate copies, and just sort of be seamless with them from one behind another, I should have the crowd in somewhat of a frenzy.
And it worked.
And it was as quiet as this room.
So, oh, no, it didn't work.
It didn't work.
What were they missing?
I don't know. I went home. I think I cried for like a week, you know.
When was this? Early 70s?
This is mid-70s as well. I'm saying to myself, well, what's wrong here? And then I tried at one point to MC, so talk while I was DJing. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I was like totally whack with that. I was really, really bad with that. But then what had happened was I figured, let me try to put some vocal entertainment to this. But the key thing was is the particular MC would have to be able to vocalize to this rearrangement of an arrangement. Mm-hmm. He would have to be able to complement with this newfound thing that I had.
So this was
here.
Not a standard way of singing or vocalizing.
This was not as I needed somebody that could just talk while I was taking these arrangements and doing these things at the turntable. So many people fail, but the only person that really passed the test for me was a gentleman by the name of Keith Wiggins, who was my first MC, mm-hmm. Known as Cowboy. Mm-hmm. And I think probably him. He reassured me that I had something, because I think if it wasn't for, like, you know, Keith, and then it was another gentleman by the name of Grand Wizard Theodore, mm-hmm. you know, like, because mm-hmm. once I was in a lab with this, I showed this to a few people, like Easy Mike, who's one of my assistants right now, he was there, and there was a gentleman by the name of Disco B, you know, but at this point in time, I was going in the park to do this, and people would just sort of stand around. It wasn't like, whoa, he's playing the best part. Let's just get crazy. So it wasn't until Cowboy was able to come up with a style, a vocal style, MC style, and he was like a ringmaster, like a circus ringmaster.
And once you got that going, we're talking here, in a way, about the very early days, the birth of rap, are we not?
Yes, we are. The birth of hip-hop, basically, even before, I mean, rap is a new title that people put on it.
Sure.
It's actually the birth of taking this newfound form of entertainment or art form and sort of just present this to the people. So Cowboy would just, he became that person that allowed people to stop watching me, because I always get kind of nervous when people just stand around
and just watching you.
Watching me. So Cowboy kind of like was my diversionary tactic, where I could just, now I can really successfully do what I do, while he just took the crowd to a frenzy.
And before you know it, you've found more guys who can do that, and you've got the Furious Five, you've got an album out, and suddenly this is part of the musical world.
Yeah.
Out of the Bronx parks and, I don't know, every place that you were having these public performances.
Yeah, I basically went from the Bronx, and then after a while I was like making the records. It took it to a whole nother level.
Melly Mel, and I'm here to say I was born on the 15th day of May. And I'm Mr. Ness, and I love myself and my date of birth with no limit as well. I want to tell you that my name is Raheem. My date of birth is February 13th. I'm King Creole, and I'm on the scene. I was born on February 19th.
I'm Cowboy, and you must remember I was born on the 20th of September.
And Grandmaster Flash is here to stay, because he was born on New Year's Day. Now we got something else we want you to say. Just shout out your birth. But to play this game and to rock this line, shout the day and the month out, one of a kind. Say 2, 4, 6, 8. Everybody shout out your birthday. To say, what's that date?
20th.
Say, what's that date?
The 20th.
And to keep these things moving right along, just shout out the month that you were born. To say, what's that month?
Yeah.
Say, what's that month?
That early music of yours that we can still enjoy today on the records has got such joy and spirit in it. It's something there, it's a brightness to it there that we don't associate so much with later rap. What's that transition about?
I don't know why that is, because I'm pretty happy with today's music. I mean, and this is the way, this is like hip-hop is no more controversial now than it was with the birth of rock, you know? And,
sure.
And like, I find joy in playing a Jay-Z or playing a Mary J. Blige, as well as a Tribe Called Quest or Rappers Delight or LL Cool J or New Shoes, I Can't Wait, or Apache Bongo Rock. You know, I just kind of, on a whole, I find joy in playing it all.
You've got a new album out. Tell us about it.
Well, basically what it is sort of it's a combination of songs that were very strong in the early 80s. It's a mix, and it's sort of just a musical interpretation of a great jam, a great party.
But of course, because it's Grandmaster Flash, it's not just the songs. You're in there doing the turntable thing that you do with those songs.
Absolutely. I'm going from one song to the next, but it's just like I'm going from one great song to another great song, from one great song to another great song. You know.
Give us some of the highlights of the album.
Some of the highlights is like I did Blondie by Rapture. I did some D-Train. Underground group by the name of Samantha. The song was called Bra. Did a song in there by Frankie Beverly Mays called Before I Let Go. Got some New Shoes in there. Name of the song was called I Can't Wait. It's like 17 songs. Can't remember all of them.
It's great.
Remember the flow though.
We'll continue our conversation with Grandmaster Flash after a short break. We're going into the break with his mix of the Afrika Bambaataa classic Planet Rock from his new CD, Grandmaster Flash Essential Mix. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
So hit me. Just taste the funk and hit me. Just get on down and hit me. Bambaataa just get so funky now, hit me.
Other piece of the world.
Where's the message of my world?
All this woman, boys and girls.
Hey, I'm Planet Rock with some work it on it.
You got the groove. Move. Shadoon, shadoon, shadoon. Feel the groove. Feel it.
Do what you want to, but you know you got to be
cool and boogie.
Out on the floor.
Go down. Bring it low. Close to the ground.
And everybody just rocking. Don't stop it.
We got to rock it. Don't stop. Working all around the clock.
Everybody just rocking, don't stop it.
We gotta rock it, don't stop.
Keep ticking and talking. Working all around the clock.
Everybody gotta rock it, don't stop it.
You gotta rock it, don't stop it.
You gotta rock it, don't stop it.
You gotta rock it, don't stop.
You gotta rock it, don't stop it.
You gotta rock it, don't stop it.
You gotta rock it, don't stop it.
You gotta rock it, don't stop.
You gotta rock it, don't stop it.
You gotta rock it, don't stop it.
from.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're here tonight with the great hip-hop original, Grandmaster Flash. Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five's rap song, The Message, took rap music to a new level. Before this song, the lyrics of rap music were essentially boasting and bragging of rap prowess and girlfriends and hot cars. Grandmaster Flash and his crew saw that political and social messages had a place in rap, too. Their cut, The Message, talked of the frustrations of ghetto life, of poverty and hopelessness and rage.
Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stairs, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head.
You begin to bring in a kind of social message, saying, hey, things are not so good here, or hey, watch out for that cocaine. Was that your idea, or was this the guys who were vocalizing over your turntable work?
This is what I had to really make clear here. The song White Lines was vocally the genius of Melly Mel. Mm-hmm. It was his song, and I want to give him like 100% credit on this song. I wouldn't even call it a Grandmaster Flash song. I call it a Melly Mel masterpiece.
Of course, he was in the Furious Five, but this was his inspiration.
This is after we parted, and this was a project that was undone when we parted. And this is something that he finished. This is something that he did. And then it was an engineer by the name of Chris Lord Alge who sort of came up with this way of taking a rhythm and making it like an arpeggiating sort of sound thing. So it was, I would give that song to Melly Mel and Chris Lord Alge.
White line.
Vision, dreams of passion.
Blowing through my mind.
And all the while I think of you. A very strange reaction. The more I see, the more I do. Baby,
tell your body to come along. But white lines blow away.
It depicted, a part of our lives, because, I mean, at one point, we were in a company of like the huge, I mean,
a snowstorm of cocaine.
And not even that, but huge artists that kind of did it. We were around the biggest and like people we grew up with, and like not all of them did drugs, but it was a pleasure to play with the Commodores or Rick James or playing with Evelyn Champagne King or playing with the Barquets or playing with, the list just goes on and on. Like people that were our superheroes, now we were on a stage with these people. So it was
What did you think when you first heard Blondie take Rapture out? It became such a big hit, and here's, of course, a white band kind of dipping in. Deborah Harris had come and listened to you and talked about you in the song. What did you make of that way of the music having its big coming out party?
Well, I take it as a pleasure, because actually I have to give this to Fab Five Freddy, because Fab Five Freddy is like, was this cat that hung down in a village. And a village was an area in New York where the white people and the foreigners used to party.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the thing about it is that Fab used to come to a Flash party, which was up in the Bronx, but he was like a town crier. He would go downtown into the village and say, yo, there's these parties, man, that you got to come see. Kool Herc, Africa Bambaataa, Grandmaster Flash, you guys got to come uptown and see it. And like, they weren't too happy about wanting to come up because of the scenario of what people thought it was, which wasn't true,
So
he had promised me that he would bring one of his best friends, which I thought was crap, Deborah Harry, to the party. I'm like, yeah, right, you can bring Deborah.
You're going to bring Deborah Harry, right.
He says, yeah, she's a good friend of mine, and Chris Stein's a real good friend. These are good friends of mine. So I'm like, yeah, right, you're going to bring them. And maybe two or three weeks later, that's Blonde, yes. And I was playing Webster PAL, and primarily, all my audience at that time was like Spanish and blacks. And then there was this woman with this blonde hair coming like from out of the darkness up close to the stage. And like,
you remember that moment?
Yeah, he pulled it off.
She was there.
She was there. And she said, I've been watching you for like an hour. And she says, I'm very pleased with the way you do your thing on the turntables, and I'm going to write a song about you. And I basically was like, oh, thank you very much. But in my mind, you know, I was like, yeah, right. Yeah, this is crap. You're not going to talk about it. Why would she want to talk about a kid in the Bronx that doesn't have near the superstar stardom status that she even had?
But that song became a huge song.
Yeah, like 3 weeks later, maybe like a month later, yeah. The song was out, and people were saying, Flash, you made a new song. I'm like,
I don't think so exactly.
I don't have no songs out. Then I went to research it, and she kept her word. She actually did do it, and she opened up, like, so many doors.
What did you think in the 80s when this became so mainstream and began to take off in such a big way? Did you think, I gave birth to that? Or wait, someone's sort of stolen my horses here?
I was happy. I was happy. I mean, because at that time, hip-hop was still in a proving stage. And it had not been totally saturated to the foreigners or to the whites or to the Germans or to whatever. And for Blondie to just come into the hood, embrace it, and then go and record this, because I mean, she still was, even if she didn't make that song, she still was a superstar, so she didn't even have to make the song. So for her to have even done it was really, like, I took it as like an ultimate compliment. And you know, Flash is fast, Flash is cool. I'm like, whoa, this is really, and I thought it was real cute that she, you know, she even attempted to put a rap on there, you know, the eating cars, eating bars. Kind of,
right.
Sort of, let's just say,
hello.
Listening, like, wow,
listening.
Eating cars and bars in Mars. And that there was sort of another twist of vocalizing, let's say.
Yeah, let's say. When you look out on this whole enormous world today, what do you think of the way it's evolved? What do you think of the guys who have made the enormous bucks off of it, Puff Daddy and that whole world?
I'm so happy, because this is one thing that's inevitable in life, and this is the way that I see it. Contrary to what a lot of people say, it's like, I am one of the creators of this art form, but there's one thing that we have no control of, and that is change. And either you adapt to change, or change will take care of you.
Yes, it will.
And basically, what I feel with all the later artists that have come after Grandmaster Flash, Kool Herc, and Africa Bambaataa, it's a blessing, because now it just opens up the door for more possibility. It's just a matter of being able to look and find your niche where you are. It's like, these new artists keep me alive, because when you speak about hip hop chronologically, you have to include Flash, hands down. You know, so that's almost like advertisement for me. All I have to do is be present and do my thing.
That's right, because you're there in the beginning. But when you look at, I don't know, Eminem, what do you think?
When I think about, I think he's a genius. I think he's a little controversial, but I just think that he opens more doors for other people, for hip hop, and like, some of his subject matters are get him in situations where it's not, let's just say, happy situations. But then hip-hop is controversial anyway, because and it's diverse, because it has different points of view. Like when Herc and Flash and Bam created this, you know, let's just say we were red. But then a person in Japan felt the love for it, and they made it blue. And then maybe somebody in California made it yellow.
A different color every time.
You know, so it's a different hue. And the thing about it is that if you don't have some sort of, let's just call the word controversy, I like to call it diversity. If you don't have, then the people ain't paying attention, because then it's too dormant. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that's just the way that it is.
Under all those colors, is there a message? Is there a fundamental message in the hip-hop arena?
Is there I think the fundamental message to me is, please come with your point of view. I want, like, that 6-year-old kid that's doing it right now will probably be the man 10 years from now. Like, please keep coming with the new cut. That MC, please come with the new style. Please, the producers, come with that new way of taking a beat. Because unlike all other genres of music, hip-hop, hands down, has unlimited ways of being created. We can metamorphosize this in so many different ways. Whereas with other than jazz, I mean, rock, blues. Like, they have they're formatted to some
degree.
A fixed
framework to some way.
And hip-hop is not. We can talk about almost anything. We can sing off-key. We can take a Frank Sinatra record. I can make a Frank Sinatra record with Billy Squire, Big Beat, and make it work and call it hip-hop.
And is there room for every emotion in there as well? Love, hate, anger, joy, or does it lean one way or another?
No, I think that it's like it's unlimited because, I mean, like you had Run DMC talk about a pair of sneakers, my Adidas. I mean, you can go like there. You know, you could have like a person like Biz Markie who can't sing a lick. You know, you got what I need, and it's a big song. I mean, you got people talking about, you know, it's like a jungle sometimes. You know, don't push me because I'm close to the edge. And, you know, we're just so unlimited with what we could do. So, like, hip-hop is a wonderful, wonderful thing, and I think the way it's grown, I'm quite happy.
And your turntable work on the new album, how does it compare with what you were doing 5 years ago, 20 years ago? I mean, you were famous for using your hands, your feet, your wrist, your elbow, anything you could make it work. What new techniques are you bringing in?
Well, I think techniques, I think probably the way that I work with an audience is I become them, they become me. And in the transition, I want us to positively get wild and get crazy. So if the audience got me crazy, I might go into a thing where I don't know what I might do, but it's like improv every night, and that's probably why I love it so much, because there's no set template. There's no set format to how what I'm going to do on a particular night. If the audience is wild, I'm getting wild with them.
How did you choose the songs on this album? What were you looking for?
I was looking for flow, because when I tried to come up with a format or a template, it was extremely hard to do, because the songs of that particular era was so strong. There were so many hits. So I came up with a bunch of composite mixes, and this one sort of felt the best. It felt the best as a first step, you know, because I want to do a couple of volumes of these. So this is, as a first step, I'm pretty happy with it.
In the age of CDs, it's not vinyl, it's CD now. How does this turntable work stay alive?
Well, quite frankly, I'd have to say that the DJ is the first line of defense when it comes to a record. And a lot of these companies now, record companies, are finding it extremely important to be able to service the DJ, because the DJ is going to take this into a club or into an arena, brand spanking new, and sort of retest it. So vinyl, although it is not the, it doesn't sell as much as a CD, it cannot die.
They have to keep making them so that you can play with them.
They must. I mean, but unfortunately, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, it comes down to dollars and cents. And from what I'm told, and I'm not really super clear about it, but it costs damn near nothing to make a CD, and you can make 10 times a profit versus making vinyl. You know, you don't make the same profit. So from a business standpoint, I would guess they would lean more towards the CD thing. But the fact of the matter is here, the true mixers that really do their thing with the vinyl are the ones who have the reputations. They have the following, and
is it an honor? Is it a privilege when a mixer comes in and mixes someone's song? Do the artists say, "Oh, please, you know, play with this, take my song"?
Absolutely. I mean, I get artists come to me and say, "Flash," like I get record companies calling me all the time, whether it's Columbia, Warner Brothers, EMI, RCA, or whatever the case may be. Got something new, Flash? I want you to take with you and just go test this. I know why they want me to test it, because a lot is leaning on whether that song is successful or whether it dies. So whether it's,
and you can help make it a success by your treatment
help,
of it.
I can help. Funkmaster Flex can help. Rock Raider can help. DJ Scribbles can help. It's like, you know, we are the first line of defense with the people, you know. And the record companies, they go the typical way, which is to radio, then it has to go through rotation, and it has to go through the powers that be, and whatever. If this has got a funky beat, we ain't going through all that. You know,
let's just play right now.
Let's get down.
What comes after hip hop, or does hip hop just morph endlessly?
Hip hop's, I would pray to God that it continues to be here. I hope that them DJs continue to do the things they do in the turntables and take my formula to the next level. And I would hope that MC would continue to do the poetry to the beat of music. I would hope and pray.
Do you still have the same joy in it today, Grandmaster Flash, Joseph Sadler?
Oh, yeah. I think I have more joy because now I have more to play with now because I've mastered the old school stuff. So now it's just so much new music and it's so much so many different types of new music that I can play. I'm like a big kid at heart. Man.
Speaking of kids, you have a lot of kids.
I got six now, right? Six kids, yeah.
What do they listen to your music? Do they think you're cool or do they think you're history?
My kids think I'm the coolest dad.
My dad is Grandmaster Flash. Come on.
I ask him so many questions. I ask him what's the latest thing, what's the latest dance, where can I see the latest thing happening? I'm constantly keeping my ear to the street of what's going on. It's really important.
Is the Bronx still your feeding ground, your most fertile area to find that? Or
no, probably more like I travel around. I travel around the country.
Sure,
now.
Of course.
And I ask plenty of questions. And like I play, you know, God has given me this wonderful gift that enables me to play for an audience. I can play for 18-year-olds in a room and play their music. Mm-hmm. And they give me somewhat of a musical barometer of what's hot and what's not versus I can play for an audience that's older, mature audience. So I can take it across the board. You know, I think right now there's just a constant want to learn more knowledge. Now I'm into want to learn this house music thing. Like that's what I want to learn next.
House music, what do you need to learn there?
If I was given 15 R&B and hip-hop songs and asked to put them into a mix from warmest song to hottest song, I can do that successfully. Mm-hmm. If 15 songs were put down of house in front of me, I probably could mix them on time, but I wouldn't know what was hot and what was not. And what makes a hot song? And what makes a body? What makes him or her move the way they do to this particular style of music? Because my thing is this music is a universal language.
Does heat move? Has heat changed? Has what's hot the fundamentals of it changed over time?
Yeah, I think with modern technology, it has metamorphosized. I think that the same components apply, but I just think these producers are just taking these parts and just sort of twisting them and making them sound different. But I think they're taking the elements and the essence of the same sounds and just putting somewhat of a 2000 sort of twist on it.
We'll continue our conversation with Grandmaster Flash after a short break. Here's his mix of the classic Last Night a DJ Saved My Life by In Deep. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Last night a DJ saved my life. Last night a DJ saved my life, yeah. 'Cause I was sitting there bored to death. And in just one breath he said, you gotta get up, you gotta get off, you gotta get down, girl. You know you drive me crazy, baby. You've got me turning to another man. Called you on the phone, no one's home. Baby, why leave me all alone? And if it wasn't for the music, I don't know what I'd do.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour to one of the great innovators of the hip-hop scene, Grandmaster Flash. He's got a new album out called The Essential Mix Classic Edition, where he mixes some of the greatest DJ hits of the 70s and 80s. Here's his treatment of the famous track by Liquid Liquid called Cavern.
There's not a problem that I can't fix, 'cause I can do it in the mix. And if your man gives you trouble, just to move out on the double, and you don't let it trouble your brain, 'cause away goes trouble down the drain. Set away goes trouble down the drain.
You're the master of that technology, the vocalization, the lyrics. How much do they matter to you? Or is it all what's going on underneath that really gets your focus?
I think underneath. And I think that probably, like I listen to lyrics. I'm pretty deep with lyrics. But one thing I realize this year, if you're going to be a servant to the public, you cannot judge. And that's what it comes down to. So, like, I won't play, for an underage little 5-year-old. I wouldn't play the A side of a certain record that had lots of profanity in
it. It's really
I'd
raw.
I'd play the B-side where they have the edit version of it, mm-hmm. you know? So, I mean, so I do have a conscience, but, I mean, overall, I'm playing the hits. So if that means I got to go in there and play maybe 60% old school and 40% new school or vice versa, you know, whatever it is, I'm just trying to be that ultimate musical servant.
But you're not
going to
pass
public.
Judgment on the new school where it's so raw, it's so sexual, no. so misogynistic sometimes.
Because it was the same way back in the days.
Mm-hmm.
It was always making
an uproar.
Same Donna Summers was, oh, I love to love you, baby.
Right, of course.
I mean, it's the same thing, the same crap. You just got a different spin on it. You know, and what's happening is with a lot of adults, if you just took the time to just pay attention and listen, like these kids have their own language. Just like when we were kids, we had our own language, and sometimes we want to do things against a grain, and that's just the way that kids are.
What do you think of the way the white youth have embraced rap? Is that just absolutely going to happen the same way white people embrace jazz? Or is it strange?
I am so happy that they did, because, I mean, the fact of the matter is, when I first was doing this thing, I would play a white jam, a black jam, a jazz mm-hmm. jam, a rock jam, a blues jam, whatever. So even the template in the very beginning was play it all if it's funky. So now my thing is I want to play in front of all audiences so that I can get funky. Mm-hmm. And that means now that I have to sort of upstep my knowledge and widen my horizons musically by listening to some house music or possibly listening to some techno or probably listening to some whatever is getting the bodies moving. I want to be able to service that public with that.
The message, your song, said, don't push me because I'm close to the edge. It's like a jungle sometimes. Makes me wonder how I keep from going under. I swear I might hijack a plane. When you look out at the world today and see the anger that's out there that's been expressed in New York City in the last 9 months, do you understand it?
Well, I mean, that particular song there had, it is probably going to be one of the songs that will probably go down in history because it's just as new as it was when it was made in 1982. And basically the song depicts stress and sort of the things that happens in urban America. It's sort of like a window to urban America, to people who were afraid to come in to urban
America.
Yeah, so
take a look in here.
It was a musical window. That's how I look at that song. It was a musical, like, look into this window here, and you can get someone of an idea of how things happen in urban America.
But we see some of that kind of attitude, that anger, globally now. Does it worry you?
I think it does, but I don't know how I can even sort of make a comment on it. Mm-hmm. I think that there is some things that are going on that are not of a hip-hop nature. It's just life in general. Things are moving a lot faster. And some people are like, wow, like what's going on here? What's going on there? And things, it's like now the world has come to, it's got to be done right now.
Mm-hmm.
Where at one point, we probably moved a little slower.
In
a prior century now. And even with artists, they get, like, straight out the press. They get a 6-week run. And if they don't happen right away, they get shelved. Whereas back, you know, maybe in the 80s and 90s, it was like, okay, we're going to sign this artist because we believe in maybe we can get 10 years out of this artist. So the first year, we're going to develop this artist. Mm-hmm. And we're going to let them make all the mistakes they can make. And then we're going to come back and give them a second album. And hopefully they will learn and they will sort of will polish this diamond carefully. Whereas now, you got to come out the gate running. And if you don't come out the gate running, it's like all of a sudden now your horse is stopped. So that could be a little scary for artists, and it can be a little stressing for artists, and I sympathize with them.
Absolutely.
When it comes to that, you know, from that perspective.
Joseph Sadler, Grandmaster Flash, we are so glad you're still doing what you're doing, and we're so honored you came in to spend this time with us today.
Thank you so much.
Grandmaster Flash's new CD is Grandmaster Flash Essential Mix. For more information on him and his performance, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Baby. Coming up, a Harvard psychologist who studies stories of alien encounters. This is On Point. With the Mel Gibson film Signs, one of the top-grossing films of the summer, extraterrestrial life is back on the American screen. Signs focuses on a series of mysterious events that seem to point to an alien presence on the Earth. Like many of us, Harvard psychologist John Mack used to be skeptical of stories of UFO sightings and alien abductions. But then he started talking to people who claimed to have had alien encounters. And he started to believe that there might be something to their stories. Over the past 12 years, Mack has interviewed hundreds of supposed alien abductees. He's the director of the Program for Extraordinary Experience Research, which studies stories of alien encounters and provides emotional support to those who say they've been abducted. In this radio diary, Professor John Mack explains how he came to believe that there is intelligent life out there and that it comes to visit Earth regularly.
I'm a psychiatrist, and I lived with the notion that there was no other intelligence in the universe that wasn't a projection of the human brain, or if there was, it had to be proven, and we hadn't proven it. So when I first heard about somebody who, in New York, who had worked with people that experienced themselves as having encounters with strange beings from we know not where, and that there were thousands of these people apparently all over the country who didn't know each other, I thought this must be some kind of a new psychiatric syndrome. One of the things that convinced me as a clinician that this was not the product of somebody's imagination or something that came from fantasy or dreams was that these stories that I was hearing were consistent among many, many people from all of the United States and many other countries who had no contact with each other, who, when I started at least, knew nothing of any media descriptions that fit what they were undergoing whatsoever. And the only thing that I know as a clinician that acts like that, that is, people having an experience that many other people are having too, is that something really is happening. The basic story is that a person is in their home, or they're in a car, or in case of children in the schoolyard, and they hear a buzzing sound, or they see a strange light. They may see something like what we call a UFO up close, but they begin to have some kind of memories of something that happened, and it's not like a dream. They really, it's a memory of something that occurred in their conscious experience of seeing some sort of strange beings, of being taken somewheres, of having their bodies poked or probed, of some kind of reproductive element in this, of being given information about and images of what's happening to the Earth, sometimes a feeling that they're being brought home in the sense of a deep spiritual kind of connection. There is physical evidence. In other words, people have been observed, or the children have come into their parents' room when they're missing. I don't believe in every case the person is physically taken someplace. That is yet to be established, although it appears that happens on occasion. But there may be marks on their bodies, which little lesions or cuts or scoop marks, which correspond to what they remember happening to them during the experience. People may see a UFO near where the person having the experience has been undergoing the experience. Many people in the community may see some kind of bright lights that relate to the experience, not just the person who's having the encounter. The physical evidence is not strong enough for it to be proof. On the other hand, it's dangerous to dismiss this because we can't prove it by our methods of three-dimensional science. We need to be able to expand how we know to include valid human experience, but that has to be looked at rigorously as well. One of the things that convinced me, again, that I was dealing with some kind of genuine mystery here was that the people seemed to have nothing in common one with another. There was no way to typecast the individuals. There was no personality consistency, no socioeconomic consistency, nothing about their point of view. They were almost without exception strangers to the phenomenon. And when it happened, they were as shocked as anybody else. And they would be sometimes come to me in the hope that I could somehow explain this away psychiatrically. They would prefer a psychiatric explanation than that this is somehow real and they have to contend with the shattering of their worldview as well as the distress of the experiences. I believe that if we can open ourselves to the possibility that we don't live alone on this, in this cosmos, we're not the only intelligence. If we can open our hearts to an expanded notion of who we are, we might treat each other better. We might treat the Earth better. We might be open to sacred realities, to the sacredness of all life. Because that seems to be what happens to these experiencers when they open up, when they go through the dark night of the soul of their encounters and begin to grasp the truth of it. So I think it has some creative possibilities for our consciousness.
Harvard psychology professor John Mack is director of the Program for Extraordinary Experience Research. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Darren Manoogian and Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by